We're going to do some sound checking. Mine looks good. Let's hear.
You want to speak something and just see if it looks all right? And
yeah, you're looking good.
Yep. Great buildings and structures that made a difference. The Crystal Palace, London, 1851.
Perfect. Well, right. I would like to welcome our guest to Sidewalk Radio today. This is an extra. The extras are typically a bit more casual and conversational. So let's, I know who you all are, but why don't we just start with you, Rob. Let's tell the folks who you are and a little bit about why you're here, and then we'll get to Brian.
Well, I'm Robert Craig. I'm a professor emeritus from Georgia Tech, retired a couple of years ago, but I taught for almost 40 years in the College of Architecture there in the history of architecture primarily.
And I, Brian and I were talking about it a little bit. I'm recently back at in school and at Tech, and I like to call it a learning experience. You folks really challenge us.
They say everybody's supposed to spend 24/7 and work very hard at Georgia Tech, so I guess that rumor still holds.
True. And Brian, let's tell the listeners who you are and what
yes,
you do.
I'm Brian Bowen. For 40 years, I was with a company called Hanscom, a British company that came first to Canada, then to the United States, and specialized in construction and project management. And I ended up my career there as president, retired in the year 2000, and had been on an advisory committee to the College of Architecture at Georgia Tech. And one thing led to another, and I was brought on as a professor of practice in the School of Building Construction, where I now teach a course on the construction industry, its past, present, and future. And partly as an outreach from that, formed the Construction History Society of America, of which I'm the chairman of the management committee.
And what do you all do at the Construction History Society of America?
Well, one of the critical things we try to do is define what construction history is, and eventually gave up and decided we will let it define itself by the meetings that we have and the papers that we accept and so on. But we issue a newsletter and publish a well-regarded journal in construction history. We are affiliated with the British Construction History Society. And it's a growing field of study in academia and other quarters.
Are we getting better at construction, or are we getting worse?
Oh, what a question. I think sometimes we forget how good we really were. You know, it is absolutely extraordinary when you look back at what the industry has designed and built over the centuries. And it's something we should be really proud of. And we're continuing to do it, and in extraordinary ways. If you were to ask somebody outside the industry, I think they'd probably say we're getting worse. But the industry at the present time is going through some upheaval of changes, a lot of it brought on by the IT coming into the industry in both design and construction in a big way.
Well, I'm going to make what amounts to a radio change order. And suggest that maybe we move you here a little bit, and then that way we can all see each other. That is the beauty of not live.
That's fine.
Yeah, that's nice. Now I can see you. I like to see the people I'm speaking with. Is that better for you?
Well, it is, except you can see me.
Gene, let me ask something about what Brian's taught me. I've noticed over the years that when I would research about newspaper articles or various accounts of buildings being built, they seem to tell you every single thing about the building except who the architect was. And what is even worse, they don't tell you who the contractor was. And so as a historian trying to just get the basic information about buildings from the past, I would always seek out who designed it, obviously. But Brian, of course, has underlined the importance about who actually built it as a contractor or a construction manager or whatever. And I think we're increasingly becoming alert to that through his Construction History Society.
Yeah, it's important for not just people who have an interest in history, I think, but also for people that have an interest in heritage, which is why we're here today to talk about a grand Crystal Palace. Rob, would you mind just kind of sharing a little bit about the history of that and kind of why we're here today.
Yes, the Crystal Palace was built in Hyde Park in London in 1850-51. It was an extraordinary building for its time. Years and years ago, I was involved in a group of scholars called the Carolina Symposium on British Studies and did a short study of this probably 35 years ago, describing the Crystal Palace as the first modern building. The argument had much to do with its prefabrication, its innovative technical advances in using iron and glass, the extraordinary speed in which it was built and then deconstructed after the World's Fair and all of that. And this has always been an iconic building, known in the history of architecture as one of the great 19th century landmarks of engineering development. We're going to be looking at it from a multidisciplinary perspective with some 9 scholars at Georgia Tech in different fields. The interest is both the building and its architect and designer, who was in fact a landscape gardener. He wouldn't have called himself a landscape gardener, but a gardener for the Duke of Devonshire, and Joseph Paxton. But it was also the first World's Fair, and so as a...
And this is 1851.
Right. Yes. Okay. There had been, prior to this exhibit, international exhibit, national fairs, and of course state fairs or county fairs. France had held one that was supposed to be countrywide prior to this, but nobody had really come up with the idea of trying to bring the art and science and manufacturing products from across the whole globe to one location to show the progress of mankind. Of course, the British were hosting it, and they were trying to show the superiority of the British over the rest of the globe. But nevertheless, and they had a large percentage of the space in the Crystal Palace. But it was something that obviously spawned a series of subsequent World's Fairs and, in fact, subsequent Crystal Palaces. So it's a really interesting building and phenomena, and because it has these various dimensions, Brian has put together a group from the history of technology, from art history, from architectural history, from construction history, and the like, to look at it from all these various points of view.
And that will be at the symposium on April 5th. I want to talk about the technology side of it, technology that allowed it to be built. Can you go into that, Brian, and then why you decide to include other disciplines, you know, outside of just construction?
Sure. Well, I think as one author wrote about the Crystal Palace, it was a building that could not have been built 50 years prior to that time. In the 1850s, Great Britain was virtually at the height of its powers from an industrial point of view. Its industrial revolution had started before anybody else, 50 years ahead of Europe and even further ahead, of course, than America. And it was a very rich country, and as Rob's just said, you know, one of the reasons for having this exhibition was to showcase all its skills and put them up against products and from other countries as well. So the reason that we decided to spread this out was partly that we were encouraged by the Provost's office at Tech, and who has consistently been encouraging the different schools and different colleges to collaborate more closely together. And the construction component at Tech is split up amongst, obviously, the College of Engineering with civil, structural, mechanical, electrical engineering, the College of Architecture with architectural design, with building construction, with urban planning, and industrial design, and music is included as part of the college, as I think you know. And then there is a Ivan Allen College, which deals with the history, technology, and society, and deals very closely with the history of technology. So we were encouraged to do this, and so I'm delighted that we've got so many presses to sit around together planning this, and I'm sure it's going to be a very interesting symposium on April the 5th.
Let's talk about what this building looked like. And either one of you all jump in, or, you know, feed off of each other with this.
Yes, Rob should speak to that.
Well, I think the interesting thing about it certainly is the scale of it. If you take the point that Brian made earlier, that this couldn't have been built 50 years before, and go back 50 years and say, what was the largest building at the time of the opening of the 19th century? There's a stables complex at Brighton that was designed that if you looked at the size of this, and I'm going to make mention of this at the symposium, that if you consider something we can all envision, like a football field, if you placed this building across the width of the football field, it would extend a little bit beyond the two sidelines, but it would only go from the goalpost to about the 10-yard line. And that was an enclosed space for a riding school built in Brighton in South England by the architects of maybe a generation or two before Joseph Paxton. The Crystal Palace has enclosed under one roof 12 football fields. The building was 1,848 feet long. Now, that's virtually the year they conceived of this. They love symbolism in Victoriana. But the 1848 length of this and the extraordinary width and height, the height is something on the order of what the Gothic builders were building. You compare the vaults of Chartres Cathedral, you're just about at the top of the roof of the Crystal Palace. So you put all this under a frame of iron, enclose it in glass, and it's just really unheard of for the Victorians to be creating and even envisioning, but certainly to have it go up in a matter of months, which it did.
Yeah, and to put that into today's term and from a view out of our window, that's, you know, almost the same volume as the Bank of America Plaza, which is the tallest building in Atlanta. I mean, I think Crystal Palace is like 900,000 square feet. Bank of America is 1.2 million. To give that is a tremendous amount of space to show off a lot of things. I don't even know how you'd go about getting that many things together. The programming of it sound phenomenal. But then to take it apart after, why was that done? Why did they take it apart? To move it to the new location, or why not build it in one place to begin with?
Well, there was a lot of debate about that at the time, and it was always planned that it would be dismantled because it was going to be sited in Hyde Park, and this was a park for the people, and it was not thought appropriate to leave it there. But of course, when it was all over, it was such a huge success that there was a body of opinion, why don't we keep it there? And this went on for, I don't know, at least a year, I think. And then eventually they said no, they would move it. And the builders, Fox Henderson and Company, had a contract that said, you're only going to be having the use of this building. At the end of it, we will dismantle it and we will own it. And one thing led to another, and they did a deal, I think, with Paxton, was involved, to move it to a site in Sydenham, in the suburbs of London, where it remained until, where it became, again, an exhibition center, a concert hall, very elaborately designed gardens, and then eventually burned down in 1935 or 36?
Early, somewhere in the mid-30s, yes.
And that begs the question. It's like, you can build this thing really well in a short amount of time. You can take it apart. You can move it. But then it burns down and it's lost for 80-something years? I mean, why not rebuild it? And did the fire, I mean, if you're talking primarily of like steel and glass, you know, it's not like some stick-built structure. It's not like a stables. Why not rebuild it?
Oh, I think that was the time. Remember, 1935, 36, the Depression was still active, perhaps not as seriously so in Great Britain as it was in America, but it was. And, of course, there was the gloom of impending war. And it was also very questionable as to whether it was a money-making project in any case. I guess we're going to come a little later to the new developments that we discovered as we were putting this program together, which may give it new life, perhaps. We'll see.
It's interesting on that because there is this effort to rebuild it, and there's a short list of architectural firms looking to design it. but I'm surprised that there's not other hosts looking to host it, like Dubai or something. But anyway.
Oh, give them a chance.
They'll have a
Dubai, are you listening? So how will this this symposium be organized? Is it in the form of a panel discussion? How is it moderated? What can we expect to learn?
Well, you know, we've struggled because there's a huge amount of information. You know, this building is very interesting. Some other author commented it's probably the building that received the greatest amount of press coverage. And media, this was, you know, magazines and newspaper coverage as it was being built. And it really captured the imagination of the public and the whole of society. And so and it's been written about very, very heavily. And so it's been a bit of a challenge in putting it together. But we eventually struck upon this approach of saying, why was it built? Who was involved in building it? And we'll be addressing Paxton, the designer, and Fox Henderson, the builders. What is it, the building itself? Its decoration was a particularly interesting aspect of it as well, and the exhibits, of course. And then move on. We're going to have a little musical interlude to involve the people from our college in music, but it turns out there are all kinds of wonderful stories to tell about music relating to the exhibit. For example, I think his name was Alphonse, he could have been Albert Sax, exhibited the saxophone for the very first time. And this was available because through the industrial improvements that had taken place in metallurgy and design, the valves for wind instruments had been invented, if you wish, and were now feasible to install into musical instruments, brass instruments primarily. Anyway, so we have a musical interlude, and then...
Great, now I need to do a musical interlude.
Yes. And then move on to the how. How was it built? And there we'll have an outline of the technological framework within which this was capable of being built at that time.
And which had a lot to do with glass, right?
Well, I mean, the three main materials were iron, glass, and wood. And iron wasn't the problem. The Brits at that time were producing 2.5 million tons of pig iron. And this building absorbed something short of 5,000 tons of both cast and wrought iron. And so that wasn't really a problem. The glass could have been a problem, but you're right. There were technological advances there. Tax changes had taken place to encourage local production of glass instead of importing it from the continent.
And just on that note for a moment, maybe, Rob, you can talk about this. What was so alluring about the glass?
Well, initially, this thing that Brian just made reference to, it had only been in the previous decade that the tax on glass had been removed. And so this opened up the possibility of increasing uses, but the manufacturers were next to none. I mean, there was the Chance Brothers in Birmingham, I think, were connected with this, and there weren't a lot of glass companies that could even produce this amount of glass. So this was quite remarkable that they were able to get the subcontractors together as well and actually pull all this off. But it is interesting that from among the commentaries that have come down when people first entered the Crystal Palace, they began to talk in ways, and this is one of the things that makes it such a proto-modern building, that sound like you're talking about a 20th century modern glass curtain wall building. They're inside the building, but they can see right through these invisible walls, and they can see the trees on the outside and the sky above and all of this. And that that perception that the building is an enclosure with solid physical walls defining the difference between indoors and outdoors completely broke down and was recognized by those who went to the Crystal Palace as being something quite different than what they had known before. And so that, to me, is no surprise, because it's exactly at the, you know, in the next decade, you've got Monet doing impressionist studies of light and his own kind of dematerialization of form. But Turner in Britain is doing the same thing with painting, with a very impressionistic interest in color and light as a subject rather than what we think of as solid reality. So that this building is just right along the line of some new developments and all kinds of thinking.
And the glass factored in almost exclusively in the name, the Crystal Palace, but it was given the name before it was ever built.
No, it was given that name while it was being built.
While it was being built, okay.
One of the writers for Punch magazine apparently is credited with using it, that title.
And initially there was a thought that they were going to build the whole exhibition building in brick anyway, so it was not, it wasn't projected till Paxton took something of the ideas that he developed in greenhouse design and conservatory design in his role as a gardener, and simply put it on steroids, extended it to greater heights and greater dimensions all over, to be able to accommodate what they anticipated to be a huge cubic volume of space needs. And of course, the goods that were to be on display were arriving faster than they could even build it. they were coming on site before they could even finish the enclosures.
That's what amazes me. Yeah. And so let's get back to the rounding out the program real quick, Brian, and then maybe talk about a few other of the exhibits therein.
Sure. So then the last session, as it's explaining, it's dealing with the hows, and that will continue with Larry Kahn from College of Civil and Structural Engineering talking about the iron and wrought iron structure and some of the innovations that were there. To Larry's amazement, for example, as he was really researching this, he discovered that they had, unbeknownst, discovered or invented pre-stressing of the iron girders without really knowing that this is what they were doing. And they certainly didn't, which is pre-stressing is a relatively new approach, mostly to concrete.
And what does that involve?
Well, that means literally what it means, that the beams would be pre-stressed so that they would, as they would have a camber on them. You've seen the pre-stressed panels that go out that you're being used to build in parking garages, those huge, big, flat things. And if you look at them, you see there's a camber on them. But these are pre-stressed with reinforcing that is stressed on the inside so that it improves the tensile strength of the concrete. Anyway, we have to get into the details, let Larry do that. And then we have a session on keeping it cool, because there was obviously a lot of speculation. Even this was in England in the summer. When the sun came out, everybody was really worried, wouldn't it overheat? And so we'll have Jason Brown talking about how they went about ventilating it and what the knowledge base was at that time for dealing with interior environment. And then finally, I'm going to talk
about... Did that have any change in fashion of attendees?
Well, no, actually, it's really quite funny, because one of the things they were concerned about was keeping it clean. And all the floors actually were of wood, very, very thick, 1.5-inch thick boards. And they were, I think, about 0.5-inch gap between them, I think something like that. So that Paxton invented a sweeping machine that go around at night, and they would sweep the dust and debris down underneath so that it wouldn't have to be picked up. Well, they discovered that the women's skirts did a pretty good job of sweeping the floor, so they didn't need to do that. Then the final two pieces is I'm going to deal with the construction logistics and as to how it came to be built in that incredibly short period of time. And then we'll wrap up with a summary of the days, the half day's events.
It sounds wonderful. I don't want to leave our listeners wanting for more on that.
It's the only building that I'm aware of when you're talking about the significance that when it burned in the 1930s, the architectural press in London had a full page obituary for the Crystal Palace. Now, I don't know how many obituaries have been written for buildings, but this occurred as this tribute to this extraordinary building when it was lost overnight by fire.
Well, I think that it's going to be a wonderful conversation, and I really thank you all both for coming here today and for what you're doing in both sponsoring and participating in conversations like this. They're very valuable, so thank you so much.
Pleased to do it. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us. Thank you.
Sure.